Hi, everybody. This is Tom Toast talking to you from New York City. I'm the guest today of Rabbi Sal Solomon on Dave's Gone By, UNC Radio.
Shalom. Damn it. This is Rabbi Sal Solomon, the founder and spiritual leader of Temple Sons of Bitches in Great Neck, New York. And the answer is Tom Toast. What is the question? The question is, who is a lyricist and songwriter whose songs have been performed by the likes of Tova Feldshuh, God bless her, Andrea Markovici, Mary Claire Herron, Maud Maggart, Katie Sullivan, and many, many more? The question is, who has written children's musicals for TheaterWorks USA? The question is, who has been an all-time Jeopardy TV champion? And the question is, who has a brand new CD called Hopelessly in Love? The answer, as I said, is Tom Toast. Oh, and the one more question. Who is on the phone right now with us from New York? Tom Toast. Welcome, Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Rabbi. And how wonderful it is, that Jeopardy technique of answers and questions makes a very good interview technique. Great lead-in. Thank you.
Oh, you're so welcome. Well, it's a very Talmudic thing, because there's 15 questions for every answer. And usually the answer turns out to be wrong, then you have to ask more questions, then the questions screw you up, and that's why we're Jewish. Are you Jewish, by the way?
I am not Jewish.
Oh, God.
I live in New York, which makes you a little bit Jewish, I think, everybody who's paying attention, but no, I'm not.
And you're in New York, and you work in the theater, which also makes you a little bit gay, even though you're not. So there we go. I don't even know. You're not gay, but you have a wife, a second wife, and what, you have kids?
I have a second wife. I have two children. My two children are half Jewish, or all Jewish, depending upon how you look at the rabbinical law.
Oh, boy. So wait, how did you meet your Jewish nice second wife?
Oh, I met my Jewish first wife.
Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me.
Children are from the first wife, and the second wife is non-Jewish.
Now, how long have you been married to the shiksa?
For 10 years.
Oh, okay. I would say mazel, but you're still raising the kids in a Jewish fashion, right? What kind of?
Yes. I mean, I'm not actively raising them. I mean, they're in their 20s now. They're kind of on their own, you know?
Are they circumcised at least?
Two daughters, so no.
Oh, no, okay. They're not African daughters who wouldn't circumcise them, I guess. So anywho, a mazel on having children and the wife and the thing, and a career in cabaret and, to some extent, musical theater. Let us roll it back. Tell us, how did you get into this very difficult field?
Yeah, I grew up in the 60s, and my musical influences were the Beatles and Simon and Garfunkel and Bob Dylan.
Jews, by the way, Simon Garfunkel and Bob, not the Beatles, but Bob Dylan, all Jewish. Continue.
Okay. And like a lot of kids, I grew up playing the guitar and played in some bad rock bands and some pretty good rock bands and some folk duos. And that was my genre, I think, growing up, was the folk and folk rock stuff. But when I was in high school, I got involved in musical theater, and certainly when I was in college, I got more involved in musical theater. My music theory professor at Yale was Maury Etzten, and yes.
Another Jew!
Yeah.
No, wait, let's slow it down. We sped up before, now let us slow it down. First of all, you went to Yale, Mazel McGlick, for musical theater?
You know, not for musical theater. It was not as if my parents were pushing me into musical theater. They were pushing me to get a good education and to find a way to make a living. And so certainly they weren't pushing me towards songwriting.
Now let me ask. I have to ask this because I know my good friend Dave, who hosts this radio program, was rejected from Yale. He could not get in. So what were your SAT scores, Tom Toast?
Oh, come on, really?
Really, really, goddammit. Dave wants to know.
Okay. I scored very high on math.
You bastard. Yes?
790 on math.
Oh, my God, that's 10 points under perfect.
Yeah, I don't know what I got wrong, but, and then on the verbal piece, I got 710.
Whoa, all right, so you are a very smart human being, Mr. Tom. Did you have extracurricular activities? Were you in glee club or something, or debate team, or master debaters?
See, I'm not going near that. So the joy and bane of my life, and one of the reasons that I ended up on Jeopardy, is that I'm a little bit good at a lot of things, And I was the only kid in high school who was on the student council and in the drama club and on the math team. I mean, these are mutually exclusive, almost, organizations. But I was doing a little bit of everything.
All right, I'll give you this, because I know that I am bad at just about everything, so I also diversify. But you were at Yale. What's the truth? What did you hear while you were there about Skull and Bones?
You know, we talked about the secret societies, and they have these big buildings. There's more than one secret society. But, you know, in the group that I was in, we kind of paid no attention to it. It just seemed as if it belonged to another world, another culture. You know, I'm a middle-class kid from East Hartford, Connecticut, and Skull and Bones was a million miles away from anything that I knew about.
And so even, what was the weirdest rumor you heard while you were there? Because it must have, come on, you were on the campus, it was still secret, and yet you were much closer to, you were by the buildings. What emanated from those buildings?
Yeah, nothing, you know, the secret societies, that if you ever mentioned the phrase Skull and Bones, and if there was a true member of Skull and Bones present, he would have to leave the room. That's not such a big deal. There were things about the initiation rites and people having to tell their sexual histories. But like I said, I didn't really know too much about it.
That's a frat party, for crying out loud. That's not a big deal to tell. Anywho, oh well. Let me ask you another Yale question, Tom Tose. Were any of your Yale classmates, have they gone on to notoriety? Will we know them from theater, movies, anything like that?
Sure. Well, so Maury Yeston was a professor, and
yeah.
He's gone on to write several Broadway shows. I had a classmate who I did a show with, a cabaret show, during my junior year, named Tommy Newman. He goes now professionally by Thomas Newman, is a well-known film composer who has done a lot of scores for movies. And
is he related to Randy Newman?
He is Randy Newman's cousin.
Ah, there we go.
The next generation, Tommy's father was Alfred Newman, who wrote all kinds of scores in the 40s.
Of course. And by the way, all of them, Thomas, Randy, they're Jewish. Just putting that out there. And who else? Who else did you know at Yale?
I'm fighting upstream here, Rabbi. As a non-Jew, I'm trying to make it in this world.
You're married to, or you were married to a Jewess, so you at least are in the territory.
Okay.
But no, they don't have to be Jewish, other people that you knew at Yale, but anybody else who went on, you know, that you've heard of now.
Sure. So here's one. Now, here's somebody who I think is decidedly not Jewish. Sheldon Whitehouse is the senator from Rhode Island, and he was a classmate. He was actually a hallmate on my suite one year.
Okay, well, Sheldon has a Jewish tinge to it, but White House, there'll never be a Jew in the White House in my lifetime, I'll tell you that. But anywho, all right, so that's a summary. And let me ask, since you got to study with Maury Yeston before he went on to do, what was it, Titanic, and he was involved in Nine and some other Broadway shows, what did you learn from Maury Yeston?
Well, several things. I mean, Maury had a split personality as well. He was a serious musicologist, serious music theory professor, but then he also had a love for jazz and show tunes. He was one of the most popular professors on campus, and I took a very arcane kind of music theory course from him called Schenker Analysis, which is
Wait a minute. Schenker Analysis?
Schenker Analysis.
Isn't that something that you go to a doctor for and he gives you penicillin?
It sounds that way.
Oh, yeah.
It's the long line analysis from a German theorist called Heinrich Schenker.
Yes.
19th century, I believe. And it was impenetrable, or not really that understandable to me. I'm not that sophisticated of a musician. I'm certainly not music major material. I'm a more casual musician. But I liked Maury, and I wanted to take the course.
Did you? And you didn't understand a word?
Well, it wasn't as bad as that. I'm sure I got a B in the course, but yeah, it was a little esoteric.
A little, yeah. Okay. If I took that course, I would be so sore at the end of the day. I would be Schenker sore. God damn it. Anywho, continue.
So, but one of the things that Maury mentioned during the course, not to me, but to somebody else, was that he was bringing his friend, Lehman Engel.
Oh my God.
Another Jew.
Yes. Actually, I didn't mean the Jewish thing. I just meant, wow, Lehman Engel, BMI. Tell everybody who Lehman Engel was.
So Lehman Engel was the legendary Broadway conductor who conducted all kinds of shows in the 40s and 50s. 50s. He was in that movie a bunch of years ago about the Mark Blitzstein Cradle Will Rock production that was done in the 1930s, where Blitzstein was a communist and they had to take the scores in under their coats because they had been banned by the government or something or other. Lehman was the conductor of that. He conducted a lot of shows in the 40s and 50s, like Little Abner and Pins and Needles, and you can see Lehman's name on a lot of cast albums. Somewhere in the 60s, I think, he started a songwriter workshop. He was not a songwriter himself. I think he wrote some incidental music, probably wrote some songs, but he was not known as a songwriter. But he was known as somebody who knew Broadway very, very well, wrote a lot of books about the making of a musical and the theory behind how musicals are created. Mm-hmm. He started a songwriter workshop through BMI in New York in the 60s.
So you were introduced to Lehman Engel, and then did you become part of the nascent version of the BMI Writers Workshop?
I did. It had been going on for several years at that point. Maury brought Lehman to Yale to teach a special seminar. So I took a course in theater songwriting for credit at Yale.
Oh, you lucky bastard, yes?
Yeah, how about that? The course was an abbreviated version of the first year BMI workshop in New York. And then when we got done with it, Lehman invited any of us who wanted to go down to New York and keep participating in the BMI workshop, so which I did for a number of years after I graduated from college.
Now, who were some of your colleagues in those first years of the BMI thing?
Okay, sure. There were some illustrious ones besides Maury. There was Ed Kleban, who wrote the lyrics to Chorus Line.
And, of course, if people know the Broadway musical from a decade or so ago called A Class Act, it was all about Ed Kleban. It was all about the Writers' Workshop itself. Did you see that show?
I did see the show, and I saw it in its creation when Ed was bringing it into the workshop in the late 70s.
Wow.
And there's a song in it, as I recall, about being, you know, because you're involved in the theater, you got to be, there's a guy who's trying to write who is not Jewish and not gay. What a hard time he's having playing against the stereotype.
That's marvelous. And who else besides Ed Kleban was in your cohort?
Alan Menken.
Oh, my God. I talked to Alan Menken a couple of months ago. Wonderful man. Jewish man, by the way. But also wonderful. So talented. Who else?
Lynn Ahrens and Steve Flaherty.
Good Lord. These are the crop of modern American musical theater of the past 20 years.
Yeah, and not that anybody's keeping score, but I think they're 50-50. I think Lynn is and Steve isn't.
I'll take half. Half is okay. If it could nudge like 1% somehow, if, what would you say, Lynn is Jewish?
I believe so, yeah.
If she could grow her hair a little bit longer and then put some of her hair on Steve, that would be 51%, and the balance would tote towards Judaism. I like to think of this. This helps me. Okay. Who else?
We've led into the whole Jewish thing because it seems like that's where you want to go. I don't really think about things that way.
Oh, I do. Every second of every goddamn day I do. But no, I'm also talking about famous people or people who have gone on to write Broadway musicals or popular songs that were part of the BMI workshop that you knew and that you... I mean, what were your thoughts about their work when you were in the workshop?
I mean, they were great. And they, they would bring in some brilliant songs. They would bring in some so-so songs.
What's the difference between a brilliant song and a so-so song?
Probably, you know, and I struggle with this in my own writing, too. I think a lot of it has to do with the spark of the idea. If you have a great idea for a song and you execute it pretty well, you can end up with a great song. If you have a so-so idea for a song and you execute the hell out of it, you might still end up with a mediocre song, you know?
So what's an example of a great idea for a song that isn't yours? It could be a theater song, it could be a rock song, whatever. But what's an idea of a great idea of a song that one would say almost wrote itself once the idea was there?
Some of the songs from Avenue Q, like, Everybody's a Little Bit Racist?
Yes.
Or The Internet is for Porn. That's a great idea for a song.
As soon as they thought of the idea for the song, everything came very quickly after that. No pun intended. What about of your own songs? Did you ever have, like, an idea, boop, and then 10 minutes later the song was written?
Yeah, I don't know about 10 minutes, but, you know, the ones that feel like great ideas certainly are easier to write than the ones that are less good ideas.
Well, are there any songs on your current CD, hint, hint, that we can play, hint, hint, that are that came that way?
Yeah, I think this first song that I'm going to mention is going to bring it all together for us, Rabbi. It's going to make us good friends, and it's going to bring a lot of the themes of this conversation together. And that song is called Shalom Santa.
Shalom Santa. Well, we're a little past the Christmas holiday, but we're never past the Shalom part with me, Rabbi Sol Solomon, here with Tom Tos and his song, Shalom Santa.
Hi, everybody. This is Tom Tos talking to you from New York City. I'm the guest today of Rabbi Sol Solomon on Dave's Gone By, UNC Radio.
Welcome back. Oh, we are here with Tom Tos, the author of that delightful song, Shalom Santa. Where can people hear and buy this hilarious and wonderful song, Mr. Tos?
Okay, good question, Rabbi.
Thank you.
The CD is called Hopelessly in Love, subtitled The Lyrics of Tom Tos. It is available on Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, at AllMusic. It's available for downloads at iTunes. You can find out more about it and me at my website, which is tomtosmusic.com. And my name, which is hard for a lot of people to spell, the Tom part is easy, T-O-M.
Oh, shoot, I thought it was an E in there somewhere. Okay, sorry, yes?
T-O-M-T-O-C-E, music.com.
Now, what is the background of your last name? I mean, you're not Jewish. We've made this abundantly clear. So what are you background-wise, and what is your... Do you ever look up your last name? It seems kind of rare.
Yeah, I've done more than that. It's Italian. It's Toce.
Oh!
But as a lot of people who emigrated to this country, names get shortened or they get simplified, so Toce became Tos. I don't know. I've gone both ways about it. I've thought about changing the pronunciation and just going Tom Toce. But, you know, Tom Tos is kind of crisp, so I don't know. I've never changed it. But Toce is Italian, and I have visited the little village in southern Italy where my relatives came from.
What was the name of the village?
It's called Corleto Perticara. I think it means pretty Corleto. It is about an hour south of Potenza, which is south of Naples in that part, in Basilicata, Italy.
Good Lord, I've never heard of these names, but they're so pretty when you say them.
I'm sure if you told me where your relatives came from, too, you'd come up with some things that, for me, would be unpronounceable.
Oh, come on. From Russia and Poland, my parents come from Chluchbevich, Manhaina Gutschadach. Every state over there, even their names. When the Solomons came over from Ellis Island, the last name was not Solomon, it was Solomon Avenchkovichka. So, you know, that got shortened, too.
Another great idea for a song is that Stephen Sondheim song, the parody of the boy from Ipanema, which is called the Boy From.
Right. Oh, yes, yes, yes. That's right. So we're talking, by the way, with Tom Toce, a.k.a. Tom Tos, who is the author of a bunch of songs, who was part of the Lehman Engel BMI workshop. But okay, you're out of Yale. You're taking these classes with Lehman Engel, but you also have to make a living. How do you go? What's the next 10, 20 years of your life like post-college?
Okay, great question. Well, yeah, you do have to make a living. And the advice that I got, I was kind of freaking out when I graduated from college.
Who wasn't? Yes.
I came down and talked to a couple of people. I talked to Lehman Engel. I talked to Stephen Sondheim. More on that in a minute.
Yes, please.
Lehman advised me. He said, Tom, I respect your talent. I think that you'll do very well. But take a look around. Theater writing is not a young man's game. This was in 1978. And all the shows that we knew about were written by people in their 40s and 50s. There were not, at that time, really anybody writing songs, writing for theater, who were in their 20s. So he said, don't make the mistake of thinking that you're going to be an overnight sensation. Take a job as far away from theater as you want, and don't be misled that by thinking if you work as an usher, you're somehow connected to the theater. Mm-hmm. You're not. Take a job in business. Take a job as far away from writing as you please, and come back home at night hungry to do some writing.
So very, very good advice. And did you take it?
I did take it. I used my math skills. Remember the SAT scores I mentioned a minute ago? I took a job as an actuary. I worked at an insurance organization doing actuarial work, and actuarial work is basically insurance statistics, insurance finance, and I...
Hold on, I have to snore a little. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm awake now, yes?
Yes, yeah, when I tell people at parties what I do, I'm a songwriter, I'm an actuary, you'd be amazed how few people follow up on the actuarial.
How many actual people follow up on the actuarial nature of your activities? I know. So you did this, are you still an actuary?
I am.
Oh my gosh, so that's your bread and butter still.
Yeah, because, you know, again, you'd be amazed at how little money you can make from cabaret songwriting.
Good point. So, but you, after work, during those 10 years, and even now, you come home to the piano, your mistress, your love, and you make music, you write songs, but have you, over those years, do you feel like you bashed your head against walls trying to get a show to off-Broadway or Broadway?
Well, I mean, I've done everything. On my good days, I feel one way. On my bad days, I feel another. So let's start with the good days.
Okay.
On the good days, I recognize that I've written several shows that have been produced for children, one of which was an adaptation of Curious George that toured the country for 9 or 10 years through TheaterWorks USA, which is...
Nice.
Children's theater company.
Apart from maybe that place in Minneapolis that no longer exists, the Jun Lun, TheaterWorks USA is one of the biggest names in children's theater, I think.
Yeah, yeah. And they were great to me, and I wrote several shows for them, as I said. The biggest one was the Curious George, because it's a name. You know, you find out, especially in children's theater, that name brands really count for a lot. I wrote the libretto and the lyrics to that, which is great because you get double the royalties when you do components.
That's thinking like a Jew, Tom Toast. Well done.
Right. Like I said, I've lived in New York. So over from about 1985 to 1995, I was involved in writing these shows for children. We did another show called Columbus in 1992, and we did another...
He was possibly Jewish, by the way. Excuse me, sorry to interrupt, but Columbus may have been Jewish. Okay, continue.
But, you know, all the while, I'm also hankering to try to get some adult shows done and to try to do more and more. I don't know, I think somewhere in the 90s there, I did feel as if I was beating my head against the wall and not able to make the next step into getting some adult shows produced. That's really where I stand now. At that time, I moved more heavily into the cabaret field because in cabaret, there is no children's cabaret. It's all about writing for adults.
You know, there ought to be. It just occurred to me. That's a wide open field. Parents would drag their kids to a 45-minute thing. It would be songs. It would be like Rafi, but in a more theatrical context. You could do that. That's I'm giving you a $3,000 idea right there.
It's great, and with a 2-drink minimum. You
That's right. It's a 2-milk minimum right there. Very good. Let's hone in a little bit on that 1990s period, because you've seen, and with all due respect, you saw Aarons and Flaherty getting shows up, you saw these other, Maury Yeston, your teacher getting shows up. How close did you get with a show to being in the mainstream for, you know, a grown-up adult musical show?
Not anywhere near as close as I would want to. I mean, I would say that I'm not in the top 100. I might be in the top 500 of people who are competitive for that world.
What do you think was the, you know, did you try collaborating with some of your BMI people?
I did. I've had some you know, look, it is a struggle, and there are 10 or 20 people who have managed to crack through and do it professionally and make a living doing it. There's another 80 people who have had some significant shows produced, but they haven't made a lot of money. And then there's the next tier, which is the tier that I think that I'm in. And it's, I don't know, probably if I knew the answer, I wouldn't be,
right,
be where I am.
Have a different conversation. I'm just so curious about, you know, if you're talented and you prove that and you have the background that you've got, and you've had people record your songs, and I just wonder about that little missing whatever. And at a certain point, I guess you kind of stopped trying for that, but you'll still write children's shows, and you'll still, of course, write songs for the cabaret theater.
You have to be, it's like I said a minute ago about on my good days versus my bad days. You have to keep positive. You have to appreciate what you have while you're still yearning for something more. And it's hard. How do you face disappointment? How do you face rejection? You keep going. Rejection doesn't ever feel good, and disappointment doesn't ever feel good. Some people give up entirely when they hit those roadblocks. I've kept going. I think in some cases maybe I have paid a little bit too much attention to making a living, too much attention to raising my kids. It's balance. There must be something from the Talmud about balance and life, and how do you keep all the balls juggling that you need to have juggled.
It's called relentless complaining. If you look in Kings 2, there's some advice directly from God, where he says, when life is just throwing crap at you and you just feel awful, the way to release is to bitch and complain. And it gets you through the day. Take it from the rabbi. I know this is true. It doesn't get better, but you at least complain about it to other people, and you make them miserable listening to you, and then they commiserate. It's a great life, let me tell you. That's what you're missing out by being a Roman Catholic.
So one of my collaborators in the 90s, one of my favorite collaborators, his name is David Israel.
Oh, I love his name!
And David is an enormously talented guy who's great at a lot of different things. He's a great composer. He writes fiction. He has composed for ballet and a lot of things. We started writing songs together in the early 90s, and I thought that he was going to be my partner. But after a couple of years of it, he got very frustrated and lost faith in his own path through theater songwriting, and he went on to do 10 other things, some of which I mentioned, like writing novels, and now he's doing web design in L.A. And so one of the problems with collaboration is you gotta depend on other people. And
right.
So however hard it is for me to make my own way in the world, it's also been difficult to find other people to help me make my way.
That's totally understood. What would you say was the best collaboration you ever had? Besides your marriages.
On this CD, Hopelessly in Love.
Yes.
Available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and iTunes. I've written songs with 12 different composers on that CD. And each one of them is kind of special. I have a great relationship with all of them. Some of the composers are no longer with us. But the living ones I have a great relationship with. I think that my favorite collaborators were David Israel and Doug Cohen.
Douglas J. Cohen, he did No Way to Treat a Lady, right?
That's right, that's right. And Doug and I wrote two of those children's shows together.
Oh.
Not the Curious George one, which is much to his chagrin, because that's the one that made the most.
Right.
We did a Charles Dickens Christmas, and we did Columbus together. And Doug wrote the music to Shalom Santa.
Oh, okay, well, good. That's the song we played a little while earlier. That's great. What have been the shining moments of people covering songs that you have written? So who don't generally do them yourself, other cabaret people are doing the songs of you. What are some of the great highlights of that?
Okay, so chronologically, I would say the first highlight was, I mentioned Stephen Sondheim before, and when I was in college, I wrote a parody of Sendin the Clowns. That's something that a lot of writers do, especially when they're beginning their careers, is you write parodies of songs for fun and usually not for profit unless it's Forbidden Broadway. But I wrote a parody of Sendin the Clowns called Sendin the Clams.
The Clams, yes.
And
by the way, the lyrics to this song are on Tom Tose's website, tomtosemusic.com. It's very cute if you want to see the lyrics. Continue.
So Maury knew about the song because he was my professor at Yale, and it was included in that cabaret show that I mentioned before with Tom Newman. And Maury got me Stephen Sondheim's address and encouraged me to send him the lyric and a recording of the song, which I did. And Steve Sondheim wrote back to me immediately. One of the amazing things about Stephen Sondheim is he must employ a team to handle his personal correspondence, because everybody that I know who has ever written to him has gotten a response, and usually a pretty speedy response. So he loved Sendin the Clams, and he recommended, he displays it on his bulletin board in his home, and he recommended it to several singers, and so I would say that the first cover that I ever enjoyed and was very thrilled about was hearing people sing my parody of Sending the Clowns.
Well, did you take that opportunity to, now that you had an in with Sondheim, to have him look over some of your other lyrics? Did you ever get any advice or chastisement about a false rhyme or something like that from Sondheim?
Yeah, you get all that stuff. I did send him lyrics. I did talk to him about songwriting. He has a lot of demands on his time, and everybody wants a little piece of Stephen Sondheim, so it's not fair to overstate any kind of claim with him. He gave me the kind of advice that he would give to anybody. He liked my song and recommended it to his friends. That was very flattering.
Sure.
He actually recommended, after we did the Charles Dickens show, it got a good review in the New York Times from Stephen Holden, and Sondheim, I think, assiduously reads the New York Times, certainly the theater section, and shortly after that, he recommended me for a job writing for a show. I think it was University of Arizona or Arizona State or one of the colleges out west who wanted to do a version of A Christmas Carol, and they were looking for writers, and he recommended me and Doug for that on the strength of our Charles Dickens show here.
He didn't see the show, but he just read the review.
But it still was great that Sondheim recommended it.
Yes, I'm like, I mean, who would turn down if Sondheim recommended any writer for anything? It'd be instant, like, okay, all the other applicants go in the flush pile. That's amazing. That's wonderful. What about some other highlights of people who have covered your music?
So then the next important contact in cabaret was Andrea Markovici. I first heard her sing in 1988. This was at Symphony Space in New York, who ran an all-day Cole Porter concert. Symphony Space used to do, and may still do, these concerts they call wall-to-wall Cole Porter or wall-to-wall George Gershwin. It's an all-day-long concert, and I went to it for a few hours, and somewhere in there, Andrea came out. I had vaguely heard her name, but didn't really know anything about her. And she came out in between the Yale Glee Club and some other cabaret singer, and she announced that she was going, that the song that she was intending to sing had just been performed by the Yale Glee Club or somebody. So she had to do a different Cole Porter song, which I believe she performed from the sheet music.
Oh wow!
The song that she performed was a Cole Porter song called "The Physician." Do you know the song?
I'm afraid I do not, although I see a physician almost every day for my various ailments. But the song of the physician I'm not familiar with.
Well, it's a typical Cole Porter list song. One of the reasons you don't know it, it is not top drawer Cole Porter. It's not Night and Day or Begin the Begin or anything. It's decidedly, I don't want to say second rate, but second drawer Cole Porter. So it's pretty hard to impress me with any Cole Porter song. It's pretty hard to impress me with a second drawer Cole Porter song, but she totally knocked me out. I loved her performance. And then I think she sang a better known song, I forget which one, maybe At Long Last Love, and that concert. She just did two songs, and I was charmed and totally swept. And so she was appearing at the Algonquin at the time, and I wrote her a fan letter and told her I was a songwriter and wanted to write 100 songs for her, or at least one. And so she got back. She got in touch with me and invited me, and Doug, I think, to, who was my writing partner at the time, invited us to the Algonquin to hear her. And then we started sending her songs. Again, everything in this world is harder than you ever think it's going to be. So she didn't take to the first song that we sent, or the first few songs that we sent. It wasn't until a few years later, actually when I had started writing with David Israel, that something about David's music resonated with her, and she became interested in my songs. And then, she was always interested in the songs, but she became interested and wanted to sing them. So that was very exciting, the first time that she ever put one of my songs into her cabaret show.
And then there's been more of a relationship since then. She's done other songs of yours over the years.
Yeah, she has. She did an album in the mid-90s called New Words, which was obviously... New Words is a song by Maury, by the way, that a lot of people know. But the album was about new songwriters. And I had two, so David Israel and I had two songs on that album. One was called Michael's Song, and the other was called A Brave and Foolish Thing. So she started not just singing our songs, but she started recording them. So over the years, she has recorded, I think, 4 or 5 songs.
Not bad.
And she has sung probably that many more in concert in her various shows.
Rather, what's a really nice confluence of things here is that Andrea Marcovici was a guest on the Dave's Gone By radio program a few weeks ago, and she was even talking about that last night when she was singing at the Algonquin Oak Room, the last day that the Oak Room was in existence, this fabled, legendary room. And were you there that night? Did she do a song of yours that night?
She did do a song of mine. That was a 6 or 8 week run, so I wasn't there, I don't think, on the last night, but I was there 2 or 3 times during the run. Yeah, she sang a song of mine called The Night I Fell in Love with Paris. That's also on the CD and in my cabaret show. On the CD, we had a guest artist sing that a lot during the run of my cabaret show, and on the album, it's sung by Jane Monheit.
Oh, excellent. So let's hear... why don't you set it up for us, Tom Tose? Tell us one more time about your album and sing up this song.
Sure. The album is called Hopelessly in Love, The Lyrics of Tom Tose. It's available everywhere CDs are sold, like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, AllMusic. It's available for download at iTunes. You can find out more information about it and me at tomtosemusic.com. The setup for The Night I Fell in Love with Paris, this is a very Andrea Marcovici kind of song. I think as I was writing it, I was channeling Andrea. We were in Paris. This was in June of 2011. My wife and I went to Paris for the first time. And I was back in the hotel room, and I just started writing in my journal and started writing a lyric that pretty much, with very little refinement, is the lyric that ended up in this song. The song is about the Fête de la Musique.
The what?
Is the Fête de la Musique, which is the Festival of Music.
Oh, okay. I thought you said something filthy there. Yes, okay.
Every June 21st, summer solstice, in Paris and I think many other places in France, it's a night devoted to live music. And on every other street corner in Paris, there are musicians playing music. And a couple of things struck me romantically and humorously about that. Romantically, it's just, oh my God, you're walking down the streets of Paris and you're hearing great musicians on every other street corner. The humorous thing was that none of the songs were sung in French. You'd like to think that you'd walk down and you'd hear a Louis Jourdan song or an Edith Piaf song or something. But I think every song that we heard was an English language rock song.
They were singing Wrecking Ball and Born This Way. What can I tell you? No. But...
They were singing Losing My Religion. They were singing By the Police. They were singing, Every Breath You Take. It was magical nonetheless. So I wrote a song about that. The other little piece of nugget of information that appealed to Andrea a lot was that there's a tradition in Paris, and I think of some other cities, of lovers inscribing their names on padlocks and then hanging the padlocks on the bridges across the river. So when you walk across a bridge in the River Seine, you see all these padlocks.
Oh my gosh. But is that a recent tradition, or has this been going on for many, many years?
I think it's been going on for maybe 10 years, but I don't think, not longer than that.
Wow. And personally, I'm very partial to lox, although I prefer bagels. But anywho, I'm sorry, that was awful. Let us hear the song about Paris from Tom Tose and his album.
Hopelessly in Love, the lyrics of Tom Tose. Hi, everybody. This is Tom Tose talking to you from New York City. I'm the guest today of Rabbi Sol Solomon on Dave's Gone By, UNC Radio.
Here with me, Rabbi Sol Solomon, and talking with the delightful, the very smart, and the very talented Tom Tose, the lyricist, the maker of songs of the cabaret and also the theater world. Having so much fun talking to him, but we haven't even gotten to that other part of your life, a brief part, but a very exciting one. Yes, we've talked about your being an actuarial lawyer, or an actual accountant, I should say. also working in children's theater and writing cabaret songs, but you are also a champion of the television program game show Jeopardy. Tell us the story, Tom Tose.
Yeah, that's right. I think it comes out of the same impulse. It comes out of my creative, artistic side. Andrea used to joke during her cabaret shows, because her cabaret shows are jam-packed full of information and trivia and important information about the songs that she sings and the writers that she writes about, whose songs she sings. And she jokes about, listen carefully so you can go on Jeopardy someday with this information. I've always loved information, loved knowing things, but I had too many other things going on to think that I was ever going to go on Jeopardy. Plus, I'm a little boy from East Hartford, Connecticut, and little kids from East Hartford, Connecticut don't go on Jeopardy. That's something that other people do. However, in 2001 or 2002, I had a close friend who went on Jeopardy, and it was like, oh my God, wow. She went on and said, yeah, she was looking forward to going on the show. Her brother had been on the show years earlier, and it sort of drove it home to me that, wow, people
if they can.
Actually can go on this show. You actually can do it. So I started watching the show very seriously. I, of course, everybody knows Jeopardy, but I never really watched it seriously. But I started watching it the season that she was on. She had the bad misfortune to go up against Ken Jennings, who won 75 games in a row.
Yeah.
She was his first victim. But both Julia and Ken were challengers. And she came probably the closest of anybody to beating Ken Jennings, but she lost.
And then the juggernaut began. My God, yes.
The juggernaut began. And so that was an exciting time to start watching Jeopardy. And I actually decided, Julia recommended me as a contestant on Jeopardy. That's one of the perks that you get is you can, as being a contestant, is you can
recommend a friend or I see.
Yeah. It doesn't work magic. It still took me 8 years to get on the show.
Wait a minute. What?
Yeah, well, because right now they administer the test online now, but I'm told that 100,000 people take the test every year. Only 10% of the people pass the qualifying test, but still, that's still 10,000 people. And they only do 200 shows a year, and they only need two new contestants for each show. So they only need 400 people a year, and you got a pool of 10,000. So numbers aren't working very well for you, even with the preferential treatment. And I don't know how preferential the treatment is, you know?
Right. Oh, my God. I had no idea. I thought everybody kind of, oh, wow. So, and you were persistent. My goodness. So for 8 years or 7 years, you took the back then it wasn't online, was it?
It wasn't. When I first started, it was not online. It was the testing was done in person. They would travel around the country and administer the test. Then, probably in 05 or 06, they moved to an online.
That probably bumped up the number of applicants, too, by a huge number. Yeah.
Became much easier to take the test. But I used those years kind of profitably because I decided, I remember a colleague, an actuarial colleague of mine many years earlier had told me that he was going to go on Jeopardy and that if he got on Jeopardy, he was going to approach it as if it were an actuarial exam. Now, we haven't talked about actuarial exams, but
thank God, but okay, yes.
Actuarial exams are like taking the bar exam 10 times in your life. They're very hard tests.
Really?
Pass ratios are very low. It's a lot of cramming and memorizing material, and if you can take that time and that energy and that impulse and devote it to Jeopardy, you actually have a theory going on, because Jeopardy is a finite amount of knowledge or a finite amount of things that they're going to ask you on Jeopardy. They're not going to ask you who your mother was, they tend to focus on certain categories.
True.
If you watch the show a little bit, you can learn those categories. They keep coming up over and over.
American presidents, world geography, what else?
Yeah, kings and Queens of England, opera, rivers, I guess that's a geography category, capital cities of the world, capitals of the United States, presidents of the United States. These things just come up over and over again. And if you just organize your knowledge, like, for example, there are 45 presidents in the United States, and most people know half of them, I guess, but don't, you know, kind of only vaguely know who served what year. It isn't that hard to organize the presidents of the United States and know what year everybody served, you know?
So, yeah, once you have that, but then even if you do know that, you have to be quicker on the buzzer than the other two people you're playing against.
That's it, right, and that is, I've given this a lot of thought, Rabbi. I was in my early 50s when I went on Jeopardy, and I was at a decided disadvantage as far as reflexes and quickness of recall goes. If you look at the record of all of the great Jeopardy champions, including Ken Jennings, you'll find, surprisingly, that the majority of them are people in their 20s. You got some who are in their 30s. There's very, very few. It gets harder and harder. You can watch the show for a lifetime, and you'll never see an 85-year-old person win on Jeopardy, or even be on Jeopardy.
Well, they'd probably have a heart attack if they won.
And it's rare to see people in their 70s. It's pretty rare to see winners in their 60s. It's a young person's game. Not so much, everybody thinks it's about the accumulation of knowledge, and it is to some degree, but there are also a whole bunch of other skills that go into doing well on Jeopardy.
And also when you're 15, 16, 70, you have so much knowledge, and so many things are interconnected with history and memory, rather as opposed to when you're, say, 20s, when it's just fact, 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 and it isn't tangled with a lot of emotion and memory and watching history and putting it all together that way, I think. You know, it's almost rote learning is easier for 20s than it is when you get older.
Yeah, yeah.
Just a thought. Anywho, so, by the way, did you learn anything from watching that first season with Ken Jennings and then the seasons beyond that, from not just what to study, but the way to play the game?
Oh, yeah, well, sure. Certainly the what to study, that's easy. You watch the show, you see what categories come up over and over again, and that's one whole big important area. Another area that appeals greatly to the actuary in me is the betting strategy, particularly the betting strategy in Final Jeopardy.
Okay.
people don't know how to bet, and it's kind of amazing. Very, very smart people go on the show, and then they blow it in their bet in Final Jeopardy. I'll give you an example. Let's say that the final question is coming up, and let's say that you're in second place, and the leader has $15,000, and you've got $13,000. And let's just say that the third-place person is way out of it, only has $2,000.
So wouldn't you bet $2,001?
You could. That would be a pretty good bet, maybe even optimal. But what you find a lot of people with $13,000 do is they bet it all.
Right.
Betting it all is insane. Because you can't, the leader is almost certainly going to bet enough to beat you doubled. So at 15 and 13, the leader is probably going to bet 11,000 or 11,001. So if you both get the question right, if you're in second place, you're not going to outbet the leader. Your only hope is that the leader gets the question wrong. That's not negative thinking. It's just very practical. You can't win unless the person ahead of you gets it wrong.
Interesting thought. So, if you do lose, at least you get to keep the $10,000 or $11,000 in your bank, or whatever, minus what you bet, as opposed to going down to zero and getting a home edition of the game and a handshake.
Yeah, well, it's even worse than that. Well, the second place person gets $2,000, so you don't even get to keep what you have earned if you're in second place.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, you only get to keep it if you're the winner.
Oh, so you might as well bet everything then.
No, you should bet. Far better than betting everything would be to bet nothing. Think about it. If it's a hard question, you're hoping it'll be a hard question. You're hoping it's going to be such a hard question that the person who's been kicking your ass is going to get it wrong. Okay? And so the chances are that you might get it wrong too. Now, okay.
But if he bet everything and you bet zero, he loses, he goes down to zero, you stay at what you were, and you win.
Correct. Correct. And that works as long as, you know, you could go, if you think that the $15,000 person is going to bet 11,001, then if he or she gets it wrong, that will reduce to 4,000. So if you've got 13,000, the biggest bet that you should ever make is 9,000.
Okay, to go up, wow, interesting.
So that you'll, you know, if you both get it wrong, you'll be at 4,000, and the leader will be at 3,999, and you'll win by
a win.
But then you do have to consider the third place person, where the third place person is.
Oh, that's right.
So much to ruin your chances there.
How much time do you have when you're actually doing the show to make those decisions as far as, you know, to once the second part, the double jeopardy, is done between having to write down your bet? How much time do you actually have to think of all that?
As much time as if you're doing a radio interview and somebody asks you a really hard question.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
If you take too long, they edit you out, and it's no problem. You get as long as you need.
Oh, you do? Oh, I didn't realize that. I thought
the cameras aren't rolling. They've taken a commercial break, and they don't want you to take a week to make a decision, but if you need a little more time, they're going to give you a little more time. If the clock isn't running while you're making your...
Oh, okay, so at least there's not time pressure in the betting part of it, just in the, once they ask the question, the final Jeopardy question, then it's... What's another thing that you learned from watching Jeopardy on how to play the game?
I learned that the daily doubles are typically easier questions than you would think that they would be. That easier questions than the, you know, the questions get harder the more money they're worth.
Right.
But an $800 question that happens to be a daily double is probably going to be easier than a typical $800 question.
So why is that helpful to know?
It can affect your betting. You should probably bet as much as you can on a daily double, depending upon, you know, where you are in the scoring and how much time there is left in the game. But I think you should look to bet a lot on the daily doubles if you can.
Very cool. Then we're talking with, and we haven't even said, by the way, Tom Tose, how you did when you actually physically finally went on Jeopardy.
Well, I'm glad you asked. The most noteworthy thing is I am in the Jeopardy Hall of Fame. The reason I'm in the Jeopardy Hall of Fame is if you score high in one game, over $30,000 in a single game, you are in the Jeopardy Hall of Fame. So in my second game, I won a little bit over $30,000, which, feeling good, did earn me a spot in the Jeopardy Hall of Fame.
Now, wait a minute. When you won that game and you made a little over 30 grand, you got to keep that, right?
Correct. I also got to keep the $7,000 that I won in my first game. So you have these wide swings in Jeopardy. A lot of it hinges on how hard the final Jeopardy question is. I got the first one wrong, but I won the game because the second place player didn't know how to bet. I won the second game because the second place player was close to me. I had, I don't know, 19,000 and she had 16,000. So I had to bet enough in case she bet at all. That's how I won, I think it was about 32,000 in the second game. And then I got beat in the third game.
Ah, do you remember the question that beat you?
Well, there was no single question that beat me. In the third game, what beat me was a guy who was very smart, who was in his 20s, who was faster at the buzzer than I was.
Did you make it to Final Jeopardy in the third game?
Oh, yeah, I did, but I didn't have a chance of winning. He had a lock game. He had more than twice.
More than double, so yeah.
Yeah.
All right, well, good, but hey, not bad to be a winner twice on Jeopardy, which is so tough to get into. I'm failing. Now, can you ever go back on Jeopardy, or is it one time and you're done, unless you're a Ken Jennings for a specialty thing?
Yeah, one time and you're out, unless you do well enough. They have various tournaments. I think they have one this year that's called the 30th anniversary show. They bring back the upper echelon of players. You know, I'm in the Hall of Fame, but man, that's nothing compared to the people who won 8 times or 20 times or 75 times. So they're the ones that get invited back. I won't get invited back.
Well, Tom Tosh, you are a winner in our book, in the book of life that we have here in the neighborhood, for being on this program, for talking about your career, talking about the games you play, and you're also a puzzle enthusiast. Last question for you, in fact. What is it about puzzles and word games and things like that that so attract lyricists? Because as we mentioned, you talked about Stephen Sondheim before. He is an inveterate puzzle maker and lover, as are you.
Right, and also Richard Maltby has been doing the cryptic puzzle in Harper's for a long time. And I know a lot of other lyricists who are puzzle creators or puzzle doers. It's playing with words. It's, you know, what is writing a lyric? It's not even the same thing as writing a poem, particularly when the music comes first, as it does on a number of songs that I've written. You need to fit a certain number of syllables on a line. You can rarely cheat. If you like the tune, you don't want to monkey with any of the notes. You want to set them exactly right. So you want to set the stress right, and it's got to fall a certain way. You've got to put what they say is the accent on the right syllable. So that's the kind of puzzle doing right there, and it's a playing with words, and it's finding synonyms for things, and it's finding different ways to express the same thought.
That's a perfect explanation of both puzzling and songwriting from Tom Tosh. Tom, what's a great song from your new record that we should go out on? What would be a lovely way to end this fine, fine interview with the delightful Tom Tosh?
Sure. This is a song that I wrote with Shelley Markham, who is a great composer and who is Andrea Markovici's music director and has been for a number of years. We wrote a song called You Make Me Laugh. We wrote it for his niece's wedding. I didn't know his niece, but Shelley had an idea for a song and wanted to sing it at his niece's wedding. I gathered a little bit of information about his niece, and I set a lyric to Shelley's tune, word for word.
Great. So we're going to hear that song now from the new album. Wait, what's that album again, and how can people get it?
The album is Hopelessly in Love, the lyrics of Tom Tosh. It features the voices of the great cabaret stars Carol J. Bufford, Jack Donahue, and Jennifer Sheehan. There's a guest song sung by Jane Monheit. It is on LML Music Records, or LML Music Label. It is available at Amazon and Barnes & Noble and AllMusic. It is available at iTunes, and you can find out more about me and the album at my website, TomTosmusic.com, Tom, T-O-C-E, music.com.
TomTosmusic.com. Tom Tosh, it has been a joy. It has been a delight. I thank you so much, and I wish you much, much success in everything that you are doing. Again, the name of the song and the name of the singer?
The name of the song is You Make Me Laugh. The name of the singer is Jennifer Sheehan.
Jennifer Sheehan, Make Me Laugh with Tom Tosh's words. Thank you, Tom Tosh.
Oh, thank you so much, Rabbi. This has been a joy, and it really means a lot to get your, dare I say, blessing.
Well, you're not Jewish, but it's close enough.
Thanks very much.